Driving in Britain is such a dreary experience. There are far too many cars on the road, nearly double what they were when I first came here in 1973. And in those days, people didn't actually drive their cars. They just parked them in the driveway and buffed them up once every week or so. About twice a year, they would get the car out. Those were the words they used, like that in itself was a big operation, and pootle off to visit relatives in East Grinstead or have a trip to some place like Paling Island or Eastbourne, and that was about it, apart from the buffing. Now, everyone drives everywhere for everything, which I don't understand, because there isn't a single feature of driving in Britain that has even the tiniest measure of enjoyment in it. Just consider the average multi-story car park. You drive around for ages, and then spend a small eternity shunting into a space that is exactly 2 inches wider than the average car. Then, because you're parked next to a pillar, you have to climb over the seats and end up squeezing butt first out of the passenger door, in the process transferring all the dirt from the side of your car to the back of your smart new jacket from Marks and Spencer. Then, you go hunting for some distant pay and display machine, which doesn't make change or accept any coin introduced since 1976, and wait on an old guy who likes to read all the instructions on the machine before committing himself, and then tries to insert his money through the ticket slot. Everything about this process is designed to flood your life with unhappiness. From the tiny parking bays that can only be got into by maneuvering your car through a 46-point turn, to the careful placing of pillars where they will cause maximum obstruction, to the ramps that are so dark and narrow and badly angled that you always bump the curb, to the remote, willfully unhelpful ticket machines, all of this is designed to make this the most dispiriting experience of your adult life. Did you know, this is a little-known fact but absolute truth, that when they dedicate a new multi-story car park, the Lord Mayor and his wife have a ceremonial pee in the stairwell? It's true. Anyway, on to more pleasant subjects. My first sight of the leafy village of Virginia Water in the tranquil Surrey countryside was a wintry afternoon at the very end of August 1993. Two girls I knew from my hometown worked as student nurses at the local sanatorium and had offered me sleeping space on their floor and the opportunity to wring their bath with 5 months of accumulated travel muck. My intention was to catch a flight home from Heathrow the next day. I was due to resume my listless university studies in 2 weeks, but over many beers in a cheery pub called the Rose and Crown, it was intimated to me that the hospital was always looking for menial staff, and that I, as a native speaker of English, was a shoo-in. The next day, with a muzzy head and without benefit of reflection, I found myself filling in forms and being told to present myself to the charge nurse on Took Ward at 7 a.m. the following morning. A kindly little man with the intelligence of a child was summoned to take me to stores to collect a weighty set of keys and a teetering mountain of neatly folded hospital clothing and to deliver me to Male Hostel B across the road, where a crone with white hair showed me to a Spartan room and, in a manner reminiscent of my old friend Mrs. Smegma, issued a volley of instructions concerning the weekly exchange of soiled sheets for clean, the hours of hot water, the operation of the radiator, and other matters much too numerous and swiftly presented to take in. I composed a letter to my parents, telling them not to wait supper, passed a happy few hours trying on my new clothes and posing before the mirror, arranged my modest selection of paperback books on the windowsill, popped out to the post office, and had a look around the village, dined at a little place called the Tudor Rose, then called in at the pub called the Trotsworth, where I found the ambience so agreeable and the alternative forms of amusement so non-existent that I drank, I confess, an intemperate amount of beer and returned to my new quarters by way of several shrubs and one memorably unyielding lamppost. In the morning, I awoke 15 minutes late and found my way, blearily, to the hospital. Amid the melee of a shift change, I asked the way to Took Ward and arrived, hair askew and weaving slightly, 10 minutes late. The charge nurse, a friendly fellow of early middle years, welcomed me warmly, told me where I'd find tea and biscuits, and cleared off. I scarcely ever saw him after that. Took Ward was inhabited by long-stay male patients in a state of arrested insanity who mercifully seemed to look entirely after themselves. They fetched their own breakfasts from a trolley, shaved themselves, made their own beds after a fashion, and, while I was momentarily engaged in a futile search for antacids in the staff loo, quietly departed. I emerged to find, to my confusion and alarm, that I was the only person left on the ward. I wandered puzzled through the day room, kitchen, and dormitories, and opened the ward door to find an empty corridor with a door to the world standing open at its far end. At that moment, the phone in the ward office rang.
"Who's that?"
barked a voice. I summoned enough power of speech to identify myself, and peered out the office window, expecting to see the 33 patients of Took Ward dashing from tree to tree in a desperate bid for freedom.
"Smithson here," said the voice.
Smithson was the head nursing officer, an intimidating figure with mutton chops and a barrel chest. He'd been pointed out to me the day before.
You're the new boy, are you?
Yes, sir.
Jolly there.
I blinked, confused, and thought what odd turns of phrase the English had. Well, actually, it's very quiet.
Now, John Jolly, the charge nurse. Is he there?
He's gone.
What did he say when he'd be back?
No, sir.
Everything under control?
Well, actually, it appears the patients have escaped, sir.
Hey, what?
Escaped, sir. I just went to the bathroom, and when I came out...
They're supposed to be off the ward, son. They'll be on gardening detail or at occupational therapy. They leave every morning.
Oh, thank Christ for that.
I beg your pardon.
Thank goodness for that, sir.
Yes, quite.
He rang off. I spent the rest of the morning wandering alone around the ward, looking in drawers and wardrobes and under beds, exploring store cupboards, trying to figure out how to make tea from loose leaves and a sieve, and when my constitution proved up to it, having a private world skidding championship along the well-polished corridor that ran between the patients' rooms, complete with whispered and respectful commentary. When it got to be 1:30 and no one had told me to go to lunch, I dismissed myself and went to the canteen, where I sat alone with a plate of beans, chips, and a mysterious item later identified to me as a spam fritter, and noticed that Mr. Smithson and some of his colleagues at the table across the room were having a discussion of considerable mirth and for some reason casting merry looks in my direction. When I returned to the ward, I discovered that several of the patients had returned in my absence. Most of them were slumped in chairs in the day room, sleeping off the exertions of a morning spent leaning on a rake or counting raw plugs into boxes, except for one dapper and well-spoken fellow in tweeds who was watching a test match on the television. He invited me to join him, and upon discovering that I was an American, enthusiastically explained to me this most bewildering of sports. I took him to be a member of staff, possibly the mysterious Mr. Jolly's afternoon replacement, possibly a visiting psychiatrist, until he turned to me, in the midst of a detailed explication of the intricacies of spin bowling, and said suddenly and conversationally,
"I have atomic balls, you know."
"Excuse me?" I replied, my mind still on the other type of balls.
"Porton Down, 1947. Government experiments, all very hush-hush, mustn't tell a soul."
No, of course."
"I'm wanted by the Russians."
Oh.
"That's why I'm here, incognito."
He tapped his nose significantly and cast an appraising glance at the dozing figures around us.
"Not a bad place, really. Full of madmen, of course. But they do a lovely jam roly-poly on Wednesdays. Now, this is Jeff Boycott coming up. Lovely touch. He'll have no trouble with Benson's delivery, just you see."
Most of the patients on Tuke Ward were like that when he got to know them. Superficially, lucid, but underneath, crazy as an overheated dog. It's an interesting experience to become acquainted with a country through the eyes of the insane, and, if I may say so, a particularly useful grounding for life in Britain. And so my first permanent days in Britain passed. At night I went to the pub, and by day I presided over a mostly empty ward. Each afternoon, about 4 o'clock, a Spanish lady in a pink coverall would appear with a clattering tea trolley, and the patients would stir to life to get a cup of tea and a slice of yellow cake. And from time to time, the elusive Mr. Jolly dropped by to dispense medicines or reorder biscuits, but otherwise things were very quiet. I developed a passable understanding of cricket, and my skidding came on a treat. The hospital, I came to discover, was its own little universe, virtually complete unto itself. It had its own joinery shop and electricians, plumbers and painters, its own coach and coach driver. It had a snooker room, a badminton court and swimming pool, a tuck shop and a chapel, a cricket pitch and social club, a podiatrist and hairdresser, kitchens, sewing room, and laundry. Once a week they showed movies in a kind of ballroom. It even had its own mortuary. The patients did all the gardening that didn't involve sharp tools and kept the grounds immaculate. It was a bit like a country club for crazy people. I liked it very much. One day, during one of Mr. Jolly's periodic visits, I never did discover what he did during his absences, I was dispatched to a neighboring ward called Florence Nightingale to borrow a bottle of Thorazine to keep the patients docile. Flo, as it was known to the staff, was a strange and gloomy place, full of much more seriously demented people who wandered about or rocked ceaselessly in high-backed chairs. While the sister went off with jangling keys to sort out the Thorazine, I stared at the jabbering masses and gave thanks that I had given up hard drugs. At the far end of the room, there moved a pretty young nurse of clear and radiant goodness, caring for these helpless wrecks with boundless reserves of energy and compassion, guiding them to a chair, brightening their day with chatter, wiping dribble from their chins, and I thought, this is just the sort of person I need. We were married 16 months later in the local church, which I passed now, over 20 years later, as I made my way down Christchurch Road, shuffling along through papery leaves, under a tunnel of lofty boughs. The big houses along Christchurch Road were unchanged, except for the addition on each of a security box and floodlights of the sort that come on for no reason late at night. What lent Virginia Water a particular charm back in 73, and I mean this quite seriously, was that it was full of wandering lunatics. Because most of the patients had been resident at the sanatorium for years and often decades, no matter how addled their thoughts or hesitant their gait, no matter how much they mumbled and muttered, adopted sudden postures of submission, or demonstrated any of 100 other indications of someone comfortably out to lunch, most of them could be trusted to wander down to the village and find their way back again. Each day you could count on finding a refreshing sprinkling of lunatics, buying fags or sweets, having a cup of tea, or just quietly remonstrating with thin air. The result was one of the most extraordinary communities in England, one in which local people and lunatics mingled on equal terms. The shopkeepers were quite wonderful about it, and didn't act as if anything was odd because a man with wild hair wearing a pajama jacket was standing in a corner of the baker's declaiming to a spot on the wall, or sitting at a corner table of the Tudor Rose with swiveling eyes and the makings of a smile, dropping sugar cubes into his minestrone. It was, and I'm still serious, a thoroughly heartwarming sight. But the inmates were transferred years ago to a special wing of a general hospital down the road at Chertsey, where they were soon deprived of their liberty on account of their unfortunate inclination to cause havoc in the wards and alarm the sane. In the meantime, the sanatorium had quietly moldered away, its windows boarded or broken, its grand entrance from Stroud Road blocked by a heavy-duty metal gate topped with razor wire. I lived in Virginia Water for 5 years in the early 80s when I was working in London, and occasionally stopped to peer over the wall at the neglected grounds and general desolation. A series of development companies had taken it over, with ambitious plans to turn the site into an office park or conference center or compound of executive homes. They had set up some porta-cabins and stern signs warning that the site was patrolled by guard dogs, which, if the illustration was to be believed, were barely under control, but nothing more positive than this was ever done. For well over a decade, this fine old hospital, probably one of the dozen finest Victorian structures still standing, had just sat, crumbling and forlorn, and I had expected it to be much the same, indeed was rehearsing an obsequious request to the watchman to be allowed to go up the drive for a quick peek, since the building itself couldn't be much seen from the road. So imagine my surprise when I crested a gentle slope and found a spanking new entrance knocked into the perimeter wall, a big sign that welcomed me to Virginia Park, and, flanking a previously unknown vista of the sanatorium building, a generous clutch of smart new executive homes behind. With mouth agape, I stumbled up a freshly asphalted road lined with houses so new that there were still stickers on the windows and the yards were seas of mud. One of the houses had been done up as a show home, and, as it was a Sunday, it was busy with people having a look. Inside, I found a glossy brochure full of architects' drawings of happy, slender people strolling around among the handsome houses, listening to a chamber orchestra in the room where I formerly watched movies in the company of twitching lunatics. Prices started at a mere £350,000. I doffed my hat to the developers and took my leave.